Death with Dignity, Vermont's the latest state to say yes.
What is turning is political will.
One advocacy group says it's policymakers finally catching up to public opinion. Plus, why Yahoo's CEO is becoming the flashpoint for the working mom debate. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. In May, Vermont became the fourth state in the nation to approve allowing doctors to offer lethal medication to terminally ill patients. Commonly known as Death with Dignity legislation, similar laws were approved by referendum or court order in Oregon, Washington, and Montana. The laws have strict safeguards. Vermont's legislation requires the patient to be over 18, have less than 6 months to live, and must have asked for assistance at least once before. And the patient has the right to change his or her mind at any time. Barbara Coombs Lee is the president of Compassion and Choices, a national organization which advocates for end-of-life choice legislation. When we talk about a death with dignity law or end-of-life legislation, what, from a compassion and choices viewpoint, are you hoping is in that legislation?
From our perspective, we hope that legislation like this enables people to live as happily and as free of symptoms and free of anxiety as they can, to really improve the quality of their lives as their lives come to an end. This is not about how many people actually use the law to end their lives. This is about how many people gain the comfort of knowing that they can be in control, that they do not have to suffer needlessly and unbearably, that they can determine the time and the manner of their death and really set their own threshold for the amount of suffering that they want to endure and the legacy of memories that they leave their loved ones.
And what is it that got you interested in this issue?
I was a nurse and a physician assistant for many, many years, and so I practiced clinically in many settings, inpatient, outpatient settings, emergency rooms, intensive care units, nursing homes, and I attended a lot of people as they died. And I saw a lot of good deaths, a lot of very good deaths, very sweet and gentle deaths. And I saw a lot of horrific deaths. And then when I went into policy later, I came to understand how the policies and the laws of this country don't really help people who want very hard to achieve the former kind of death, a gentle and a sweet death. When lawmakers and policymakers gather stakeholders, what they call stakeholders, together, you know, to hammer out a bill or a policy, the people they gather are the institutions. They're the hospitals and the providers and the physicians and the insurance carriers and the PPOs. Those are the people they gather. They don't gather patients. They don't gather consumer voices. And in fact, these are the people who have the greatest stake of anyone. So I decided that I wanted very much to do whatever I could to raise the voice of consumers, raise the voice of patients, and particularly patients who were nearing the end of life and wanted to do so on their own terms. You know, women are the caregivers of society. It's mostly women who are at the bedside of their dying loved ones. It's mostly elderly women who care for and witness the death of their lifelong spouse. So women understand the kind of suffering. They understand how hard it is to die sometimes and how really cruel the dying process can be, how cruel and prolonged the dying process can be, because they're there. They're the caregivers. Women themselves are more likely to suffer untreated pain at the end of life. Now, that's statistically apparent and available through research. Women's end-of-life wishes are more likely than men's to go unheeded. And finally, I think this kind of gets to the crux of it. Women understand. Women are inherently more comfortable at the boundary between life and death. We know how precious life is. We've put our own lives on the line to bring new life into the world. We don't discount the value of life, but we also inherently understand that there is a time when life ends, there is a time when it is right for life to end. And there's no greater authority than the person themselves about when that time is right.
And I think one of the biggest objections to this kind of legislation is the fear that is raised that you are surrendering your choice to the medical establishment, the concern that choices will be made for you. And I'm going to guess that from your standpoint, you're seeing this as an opportunity to embrace and be more responsible for your own choices.
Exactly. And with the fears that someone else will have control if a bill like a death with dignity bill comes into play, the opposite is true. The fact of the matter is that doctors do hold all the power now. They decide when suffering has reached its maximum. They decide when the time has come to reduce interventions and allow a natural death. They decide when it's time to increase a morphine dose. Patients don't really have very much to do with decision-making. A bill like this that allows patients to ask their doctors for medication that they could have and that they could self-administer at a time of their choosing to cause a peaceful and a gentle death, that shifts the power from the physician to the patient. For the first time, the patient is empowered with the means of their own peaceful and gentle death. They may take that medication, they may never take that medication. And indeed, in Oregon, where a law like this has been in effect for 15 years, many, many people obtain the prescription, some even fill the prescription, and they never ingest the medication. They derive an enormous amount of peace of mind and comfort and a sense of control that improves the quality of their lives, relieves some of the anxiety of how their lives might end in suffering or some kind of agony. They have that control, they feel empowered, and they may exercise that control or they may not. But it's important to remember that the control and choice resides with the patient from the beginning to the end. It never transfers to anyone else.
And you bring up an important point. What we're not talking about in this country is what's already happening. Like in the case of my mom, who was in the hospital for 6 weeks in a coma, dying of cancer, and the doctors finally said it is time to stop feeding her intravenously and let her go. But we don't want to talk about that.
We don't want to talk about it. It's surreptitious. It's underground. It happens with kind of coded language, winks and nods. It's a very unsatisfactory and disempowering arrangement. What happens now is, I've heard stories of family members sitting vigil at the bedside of a dying person, and clearly death is approaching. Suffering seems to be increasing. A nurse or a hospice personnel will come in and say, here's some morphine. Give them as much as they need and emphasize those words. And then they leave the room and the family members turn to each other and say, what does she mean? If you can't speak clearly, if patients can't articulate their deepest desires openly and honestly, then it's all subject to this very covert, coded conversation. Nobody really knows what is going on, what is permissible, what is expected of them. And they finish the experience always feeling like, did I do the right thing? Did I do too much? Did I do enough? I feel guilty because I let Dad suffer. I feel guilty because I didn't let Dad suffer. Dad asked me to help him over the threshold. I said I couldn't do it. I was afraid of breaking laws. I feel guilty about that. There's a whole morass of decision making and shame and guilt coded language in the way that we do it now. We need to remove all that. We need to make this transparent. We need to allow people to speak their truth, speak their desires, ask openly for a way to escape their suffering if it comes to that, be able to gather around the bedside if they do decide to take their medication, say a last goodbye, have everyone aware of exactly what is happening, have the patient take that responsibility on themselves if they choose to, so that no one in the family is left with the doubts and the second guessing about whether they made the right decision for the patient.
And this is now legal in 4 states in this country. Is the tide turning in public opinion?
The tide doesn't need to turn in public opinion. Public opinion has been on the side of Aid in Dying, Death with Dignity for decades. What is turning is political will. For decades, there has been a mismatch between public opinion and political will. And the people who are of the minority opinion, who say, no one should ever be allowed to determine the time and the manner of their own death. That is just an affront to God. It's an affront to our societal values. Those people are in the minority, but they have, up until now, held power and held control in the legislatures of America. This is the first time that the people who we elect, to go to the state house and make laws for us, have summoned the political courage to vote in line with the desires of their constituents.
And any discussion of this topic has to bring up the name of Dr. Jack Kevorkian, who is the argument that many people use against death with dignity bills, the concern that this opens the door to the abuses of a Jack Kevorkian.
I think we're in danger of engendering more Jack Kevorkians if we don't pass legislation like this. Because when people feel desperate and they feel as though the law denies them their dignity and their authority at the end of life, that's when they go to people like Jack Kevorkian. There are no Jack Kevorkians in Oregon. There are no Jack Kevorkians in Washington. When people can go to their own doctor, the doctor who treats their cancer or their ALS, and have a frank conversation with that doctor about, can you empower me, doctor, with a prescription, a medication that I could take? And the doctor is allowed to say yes. There's no need and no room for the Kevorkians of the world.
Barbara Coombs Lee is the president of Compassion and Choices, a national organization which advocates for end-of-life choice legislation. Coming up, a woolly American success story and an opinion on the uproar over Yahoo's top mom. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1247. Since the implementation of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, almost all 3,000 textile mills in New England have closed, devastating local economies. When the Eastland Woolen Mill in Corinna, Maine shut down in 1996, a family of woolen mill factory workers bought the old machines and moved them to their barn. Since then, the Marchalettas have been employing the entire family and even members of the community that once worked at Eastland. They turn wool into the yarn that makes tennis ball fuzz, enough to cover 1 million tennis balls a week. In 2011, Rupa Maria prepared this profile of Ruth Marchaletta and her sons, the owners of Family Yarn.
Hi, come on in. You want some coffee? I'm Ruth Marchaletta, and these are my boys, Mike, Gary, Joe, and then comes Downey, but he's not here yet. In the morning before work, the boys come down for coffee break.
Is everybody ready for deer season?
Oh, yeah.
We all used to work at Eastland Woolen Mill in Corinna before it closed in 1996. In Eastland, I was a hand mender, making cloth that would be a second or a third into first quality. That kind of work was great. Some of the materials are very hard to work on. Make your hands sore, your back sore, your eyes sore. Used to be hundreds of mills in Maine. And now there is. I don't remember, but I think there's only a couple of them left in the whole state. Most of them are gone. All four of the boys worked at Eastern Woolen Mill. And when the mill closed and left everybody out of a job, we Marchelettas did something different. We went and made our own mill.
It's Family Yarns Incorporated. Well, it's one big happy family. Most of the time.
That's Joe. He's a mechanic at heart. Joe is one of those kids that would take a watch or a clock, take it apart, see what made it tick. And then he would put it back together again, which surprised us. And he was only 8 years old. Oh, he loved the machines at Eastland, something fierce. Especially the card machines. You put big heaps of wool in one end of the card machine, and out the other end comes spaghetti strings of yarn. Joe knows his machines inside and out.
One day, Gary and I were sitting at the coffee table, and Eastland was selling off, going to have an auction. We were just jokingly had mentioned, finally they're going out and they're going to get rid of all that junk. Maybe we ought to buy one of them old machines and just do something with it.
It really was kind of messy, and it was pretty banged up. You know, people didn't care at the end. They knew they were losing their jobs, basically.
Here comes Tony. Hello, Sonny. Did you want coffee?
So Gary and I went up and we took a look.
Shut the damn door, you were going
to buy? We went in there and talked to the guy, and he threw a price at us, and we said, man, that's cheap.
Each machine had to be torn down into sections and put on wooden skids and then loaded into a trailer and hauled here and then reverse the process to put them back together. Card machines, a complete card probably weighs in the vicinity of 100,000 pounds.
We had no place to put it.
So my boys built a place for the old machines just down the road in front of Joe's house. And the old barn that used to have goats in it is now a woolen mill.
Machines are old machines. The card machines, our oldest one out there dates back to 1894. The newest one we get out there, I think, is around 19.
Today, the mill is turning wool into tennis ball yarn. You know that fuzzy stuff on a tennis ball? It comes from yarn made in our barn in Maine.
The front part, the finish condenser, those are around 1958.
You'll find Gary, Mike, and Joe down at the mill working, and their wives. Even Joe's son and his wife work there. Tony does all the trucking for the business. I think that because the boys have different knowledges of different things, it makes it all work. And me, I'm the mom, yes.
We just all chipped in and worked on together. And really, that's how the name Family Yarns came about.
We've been making different specialty yarns for a few years now. Camel hair, woolen blends, even raccoon hair.
These spinning frames, same era, around 1958, 1960. They've probably been in a dozen mills during their lifetime, just keep getting dragged around.
I like to watch the wool being worked by these old machines. Some of it flies off and goes through the air and sits on top of the giant metal wheels and rubber belts. Looks like little angels, or maybe snow and even poodles. But things aren't all just fine and dandy out here. Industry is changing and going downhill fast.
The manufacturing in this country now is gone.
People had to move. They had to move their kids around the state trying to find a place to live and have a job. It gives them that hopeless feeling because what do?
And the way that the factories are going out of business everywhere, there's just not a lot of work out there to do it.
It's all gone overseas. Just to keep some of our jobs here. People like myself, we like to work. No matter how old you are, it doesn't make any difference.
People in general have got to start waking up and start buying American. If you want our people to work, you got to buy our products.
Well, I do that. I look for the toilet tissue that comes from Maine, which is kind of a small thing to do, but it's my way of fighting back because I know what it's doing to all of our industries.
Where does the state of Maine get the paper that they use to make hunting licenses? Do they get it from the United States or do they buy it from Canada? And it just irritates me knowing that even some of our federal prisons are eating Canadian potatoes. You know, it just, It would get me all wound up.
You know, if something happens with the mill that we don't make it, I'm sure that we're all going to do something and make something of ourselves. We always have.
We'd lose everything if it did go under.
We really have just one customer that we actually are dealing with at this time. Yeah, I wake up in the morning, and I always cringe thinking, is this going to be the day the phone's going to ring? Is this the one? Is this the bad call? Too bad, so sad, see you later.
Well, I'd like to say it's going to go forever, but I don't think it will. I mean, I'd like to see it go as long as we're around.
Today, it's cloudy. I'm dragging. I'm pessimistic. Probably tomorrow will be optimistic if the sun comes out. We've had a lot of cloudy days this year.
Well, we've put our heart and soul into this place, trying to come from the bottom and try to build it and make it work.
But who knows what's going to happen here? How long we'll be able to hold on?
Ruth died last summer at the age of 80, but the business is still going strong. Let's talk about working moms. Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer has had her share of headlines and criticism after promising to take a shortened maternity leave, banning telecommuters, then building a nursery next to her office. Daily Beast writer Jessica Gross says she thinks Mayer's a scapegoat, but it's an opportunity to discuss the issue.
When Marissa Mayer took the job as CEO of Yahoo, I believe she was 7 months pregnant. And when she took the job, she said she was only going to take a few weeks of maternity leave and she would work throughout it. People were very upset by this and thought it was setting a bad precedent for other women in the workplace and that other women in the workplace would be forced to take similarly short maternity leave. Even though later on she gave her workers at Yahoo longer maternity leave than they already had, it sort of still didn't take that critical lens off her.
So is all of this a backlash that we culturally want women executives to be more family friendly and she's not being seen as that?
Yes, I think that's exactly what's happening. I think we expect women to be more, especially women with children, to be more empathetic to the struggles of other women who have children. And certainly there's a huge inequality with the way she gets treated and the way the average worker gets treated when it comes to maternity. I mean, there's been a lot of news about how she built a nursery next to her office, and tons of women would love to have that, to have their kids be looked after by daycare on staff. And I think there's a certain amount of jealousy, is too pejorative a word, but just upset at the unfairness of it all, how hard it is for the average woman to manage having a difficult, time-consuming job and also to have a family.
Jessica, do you see it as perhaps an opportunity to really get these discussions out in the open? Because this is sort of a flashpoint where people are paying attention, so now they're talking about it.
I really do hope that this is an opportunity to continue discussions about this issue. And as I wrote in the piece, if everyone who complained about Marissa Mayer's individual choices lobbied Washington to get paid maternity leave on the books for paid parental leave, rather, it should be for men and women, on the books for Americans, that would be a lot of time better spent. I mean, we are the only industrialized country that does not provide paid maternity leave for our citizens. We are one of only a handful of countries in the entire world that doesn't provide paid maternity leave for our citizens. I mean, when countries like Iran and Uzbekistan are treating their working women better than America does, it's a really sad state of affairs, I think.
Jessica Gross is an author and writes for The Daily Beast. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.